You're listening to By the Well, a lectionary podcast for preachers. But in these strange times of isolation, we give a big shout out to all of you who might be listening to us as you reflect on the readings for the week from your home. I'm Fran Barber.
And I'm Robin Whittaker. Welcome to our podcast. Fran, we're here in what is possibly one of the strangest Easter seasons of our lives, at least.
Definitely.
Where most of us have not been able to celebrate Easter in the way we might usually, which is gathering to worship together.
No.
I remember in America when I lived there for 10 years, I used to love Easter because it did correspond with spring and there was such a celebration of coming out in the great weather, and people would actually, Americans dress up for church, so people would wear their new frocks and all this kind of stuff. And so, you know, that's not quite the same in Australia, obviously, but there is something really sad about not being able to celebrate together.
Well, I wonder this year whether in the Southern Hemisphere, when we can gather again, it might be closer to spring and there will be an air of celebration. Well, there will be an air of celebration, definitely.
Yes. And that throws up one of the big questions for this week and this time, which is how do we proclaim the good news? How do we rejoice in the good news in the midst of what feels like very dark and uncertain times? I think that's the challenge. And we've decided the lectionary gives us, quite unusually, a series of weeks on the one epistle after Easter, and that's 1 Peter. And we've decided we will focus on that. We'll talk about other readings as we do, but that's going to be our focus over the next few weeks. So if you don't know 1 Peter, it might be great to read that through.
It won't take you long. It's not very long.
No, that's true. But it's not something most of us ever preach on or have studied.
No, well, I would have to admit that I would be one of those.
Yeah, I'm the same. And there's two reasons we chose it. One is actually an ecumenical one. I was part of a group of biblical scholars preparing Bible studies for the big Anglican Lambeth conference, which was supposed to happen this year and has been put off a year now. And the Archbishop of Canterbury had chosen 1 Peter as the focus text for that conference, which at first I was like, oh, why 1 Peter, if I'm honest? And then as I read it, and this goes to the second reason to talk about it right now, is it's a profoundly relevant text for our times.
Yes, and it strikes me as one that speaks to the Christian experience in its most diverse ways.
Yes.
Most clearly, perhaps, to those in persecution in the countries where that is the case around the world, Middle East and parts of Africa. But also it speaks to people who are through dark times in more comfortable contexts.
Yep.
You know, it's got something to say to the whole spectrum.
That's right. That's right. So the passage for today is 1 Peter chapter 1, verses 3 to 9.
But already we want to challenge that, don't we, Robin?
But we think you should read the first couple of verses as well.
Because who Peter's writing to, or how he describes those to whom he's writing, is very important.
Yes.
And does lead to also to some translation issues. Take us there, Robin.
Fran's handballing to me right now. So Peter calls himself the apostle. Of Jesus, and he writes to, and depending on the translation you have in front of you, it could be to the sojourners, to the exiles, to those who live as foreigners, among the diaspora or the dispersion, and then he names a whole bunch of places which are regions of modern-day Turkey or ancient Asia Minor. Mm. So he's writing to these Christians that are kind of dispersed throughout a large geographic area.
And they're a minority.
And they're a minority in their ancient culture. They would very much have been, minority groups. And he calls them this, I quite like the word sojourners because it has this sense of you are, you're living in a place.
But you're on the way or you're on.
Well, it's not your permanent home.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Some translations will have exiles. I think that's a little too strong. These aren't people who are forced into exile in the Hebrew Bible sense.
Yeah, I've heard just a bit of a tangent, you know, conversation now around our situation of not being able to gather as Christian communities in a church building as being in some sort of exile. But I think we need to be quite judicious and careful about the use of that word, as you say, because it really does refer to political persecution or state sanctioned or some sort of forced removal. Yeah. And we're actually doing what we're told by the government for very good reason in this situation.
We are, so, I mean, we're being forced by a virus that we can't see with our naked eye, but we are also choosing to do the isolation we choose is actually out of love and compassion for our neighbours. So there are different I think exile's too strong a word.
But so maybe diaspora would be a better use of the term, better word.
And it's a word we do get in a couple of places throughout First Peter's letter, this letter. I think right now, I don't know about you listening, but I very much have a sense of feeling like a Christian community that is dispersed.
Mm.
And I know we're all attempting to communicate, and there's various very creative ways people are doing that through live streaming and, Zoom conversations and all these ways we're connecting differently. But it still does feel like we're pretty dispersed right now, that we can't gather in our normal way.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think there's a lot of ministers worrying about much older people who can't use the technological ways of connecting. And so how do we do so? How do we gather the people in lots of different ways?
That's right.
And not actually see one another. So I think it's really challenging how we're the body. But it's also an opportunity to show that the church is throughout the whole city.
Yes.
Not just in one place.
No, that's true. And around the world, we do have this deeper sense of community that says we're connected not only to the people we know, but to Christians around the world and to Christians who've come before us and who will come after us. That is part of that broader sense of being a community of saints in a Protestant sense of that. So Peter's addressing this dispersed group who might equally feel very isolated, quite fragile in their communities, not having much local support.
No, and there would have been a paganism going on around, so a worship of multiple gods, I presume.
Yes.
So, even a rudimentary knowledge of what it is, who it is they worship would have been very odd.
Yes, they would have been considered quite strange in their context. And he'll go on, and we'll talk about this in later weeks. Part of the suffering they face there is a hostility because of their faith.
Yeah.
But we won't get into that today. So we should say something about Peter.
Yes. Well, So I wanted to ask you, Robin, so Peter denied Jesus three times, and yet I'm not really aware how that's addressed in the tradition. I mean, Judas gets sent away and,
in some traditions kills himself,
But Peter, I know he's named as the rock of the church, but here he is writing a letter and he's exhorting and supporting and rejoicing with the Christian community. And if I think about Paul, he was from persecutor to deeply faithful, and there was some extra strength to his witness and testimony, I think, because of the big metanoia, the big conversion that he went through. So what's going on with Peter?
Yeah, good question. So we should remind ourselves, Peter, in many ways he's a big figure in the Christian faith, but we don't actually know that much about him historically. He's the first called in the Synoptic Gospels, Simon Peter. Was a fisherman from that Galilee region, so probably quite similar background to Jesus in terms of would have spoken Aramaic, had a trade, sort of a middle-class trade, being a fisherman. And we know from Mark's gospel it's his mother-in-law who Jesus heals, so he would have been a married Jewish man.
Yep.
And he leaves that and travels with Jesus. He becomes a really important figure in early Christianity. Paul refers to him in Galatians and other places as one of the pillars of the church. So he's recognized by early Christians, after the death of Jesus, as a real leader, significant leader. But your question is great. How did he get there when he's also the one that denied Jesus?
And I don't know of any place in the scriptures where anyone said to him,
"But you're forgiven."
But Peter, you said you denied Jesus, so who are you to tell us?
I know. I bet someone thought that though.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Well, he gets restored in the Gospels a bit. So all of the resurrection, accounts at the end of the Gospels, even in Mark that doesn't have an actual resurrection but has an angel sending the women on a message, names Peter. Go tell Peter and the other disciples, which I think is a way to actually let readers know Peter is now included.
Yeah.
The risen Jesus has included Peter again. In John's Gospel, there's that famous scene of Jesus asking Peter three times, "Do you love me?
Yes.
Feed my sheep."
Yes.
And I think the fact it's asked three times and Peter says, "Yes, I love you," Ark, why do you keep asking me this question? is a way to restore him three times for the denial three times.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
Historically, we think Peter died in the 60s around the time that Paul did and was probably killed in Rome.
Martyred.
Maybe martyred or at least caught up in the Emperor Nero famously blamed the huge fires that destroyed much of the city in the 60s on Christians. He needed a scapegoat.
Of course.
There's no evidence Christians started them, but he blamed this this strange new cult that everyone was suspicious of. And there was quite significant killing, public crucifixions of Christians at that time. And we think Peter died during that.
Which, if it's, I'm not leaping to funny places, this letter here, I understand, is probably written between 70 and 90.
Yes. So there are some people who think this is an authentic letter of that historical Peter.
Right.
And I can see the appeal of that because it would mean that we have his words in one place. Like it would be the only words of his we have. And we know Paul because we have his words.
Yes.
In a way we don't with some of the other early Christian leaders. But I think there's lots of reasons that this is actually probably written in the 80s and 90s. Written in the name of Peter, which is not fake as we think of it in the contemporary world. It's actually honouring the tradition of Peter. And there's lots of, we know from the second century, there's a Gospel of Peter, there's an Apocalypse of Peter, there are other letters of Peter. So Christians would continue to write in the name of Peter to kind of keep his tradition alive. So I won't go into all the nitty-gritty, but there are various theories that scholars come up with in terms of who wrote this. And there's a couple of clues in the text we'll point to, but the word Christian is used here. The word Babylon is used for Rome. These are both terms that really only get used
later.
Okay. And also the Greek is really good. So if you're a minister listening at home who tries to keep up their Greek by reading the New Testament readings in Greek.
There's thousands of you out there, I know.
I know there are some of you. And if you've read this and gone, oh, my goodness, this is hard, you are correct.
Well, yes, I think you were telling me, Robin, that is it the verses that are down for today or the is one Greek sentence?
Yeah, verse 3 to 12 in your English Bibles is one sentence in Greek, one big, long, complex sentence. So it's if you try and read it in Greek, it's very easy to get lost in how the argument is unfolding.
Yeah, and I don't think that's just not a curiosity. I mean, it is an interesting thing to point out, but it also does indicate the level of interpretation that's gone on in inserting the grammar in the various translations where it's happened.
Yep. Yeah, that's right. The other grammatical point we might make, and this will get us into the content of the text, I promise, is there are something like 35 imperatives in this first chapter. And Eugene Boring in his commentary talks about this actually being a call to action as a letter. So imperatives being commands, you know, hope, have faith, do this. But he also points out that each of them is preceded by an indicative, that is a verb about what God has done.
Yeah.
So there's God's action. There's a reminder that God has done this and therefore you do this.
Gift and injunction.
Yes.
Is another way that I've thought about it.
Yeah. So I think it's a text that actually speaks to how we live as Christians. Like, yes, here's the theology, here's what God has done, and the so what, how does that impact your life? So maybe we should get into some of that nitty-gritty.
And it's not so much, well, yes, I think, I mean, I wouldn't disagree with that scholar, of course. It's a call to action, but it's also about a state of mind and being.
Yeah.
It's not just about go and do stuff, which we liberal Protestants are very good at doing. About a posture, a demeanour in life and in life in extremis.
Absolutely, yeah. That's good nuancing because it's not about go and do a whole lot of things.
Yeah, and it's, therefore you've, you know.
Yeah.
Right.
So he starts in verse 3 with this blessing, this classic sort of thanksgiving or blessing prayer, blessed be God, and straight to the resurrection here. Because God has given us hope or living hope through the resurrection of Jesus. So, you know, in this Easter season, he goes straight to the resurrection, as does the Acts reading. The resurrection is the basis for Christian hope.
Yeah. And I think that new birth, that's a really, You could really do a sermon on what is meant by that phrase. Is it about a whole new household and family that emerges from this gift of resurrection, calls a people that is then a new family in a whole new way, which in the ancient context would have been very provocative.
Yes.
In a world where you only looked after your own.
Yes, and family was so absolute. Blood was. Biological family was so key.
Whereas this is indicating, I think, one of the radical aspects of the Christian community was the notion that it was a household and a family.
Yes.
In that way.
Yep. And it talks here about maybe one of the things to unpack is verse 5, which talks about we who through faithfulness are protected by God's power for a salvation ready to be revealed in the last age. In this day and age, we're seeing some things come out of the more extreme ends of Christianity, talking about how if you're just faithful, God will protect you from coronavirus or, you know, there's a strand of Christianity that's always done that. If you just pray hard enough, you're immune. But I don't think this author is in any way talking about God's protection making you immune to the world's suffering.
No, absolutely not. And I mean, presumably they had members being killed and persecuted around them a lot.
Yeah. And so, also getting sick and
doing
all the normal things that happen to human beings.
So it's much more that God is present. Yes. You will not be protected from those realities of life, but you are not alone in them. And there's something, I think what he's conveying here is the utterly present hope.
Yes.
The present hope that points to a future that is guaranteed. It's not some wishful thinking, but that it has happened in the resurrection. God has come this close.
Yeah.
And that has changed our now because it's changed our future.
Yeah. There's very much in this letter this sense of the double perspective Christians are called to have. Like, we are called to live and be in the present world, and we can't do anything other than that at one level.
Although some have tried
mystic kind of.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, living completely differently but as Christians we're also called to live, and this is where the sojourner's language becomes important again. I mean, the letter to the Hebrews will talk about it differently, but like as sojourners on earth, our true citizenship is in heaven. So that sense that knowing there's an ultimate destiny, there's a future that looks very different is supposed to reshape our present. But it's that double perspective that we live in these two.
I'm reminded, if I can get personal for a minute, of a baptism I conducted in my last parish of asylum seeker baby who was refused citizenship of the country of his parents' birth and is refused Australian citizenship. So I was baptizing this child and I claimed him, or not I did, God did, but I named, so he's been rejected as a citizen of these countries. But he's today in his baptism becoming a citizen of heaven.
Yeah.
And there's something I think that perhaps illustrates what you're talking about.
Definitely. No, that's beautiful. That demonstrates it really aptly that, and of course in Peter's context, there is a sense that the world is hostile in the same way that a refugee or an asylum seeker would experience the world as so profoundly hostile and a lot of states as so unwelcoming.
Well, indeed, the mother of this child had converted to Christianity and that was death in her home country.
Yeah. And, I mean, you're reminding me, Fran, that when we look at, you know, I think in the West, let me say this first, for those of us who've grown up in fairly comfortable situations, it's not to say we don't face our challenges and grieve and loss and all of those things, but, you know, on the whole, we're relatively comfortable. We can, or we perhaps don't think too hard about celebrating or suffering in the way that others do. And yet Christians in places where they're persecuted, where life is incredibly difficult, actually know how to celebrate. There's a strange paradox.
Yeah.
I remember when I worked as a school chaplain, the senior girls had gone off on a trip to, I think it was Kenya somewhere, like a kind of a mission trip to Africa. And they came back and several of them said to me, we couldn't believe how happy they were when they had nothing.
I'm reminded actually of a Kevin MacLeod program where he went to India and had a documentary about how he would perhaps create a living environment that was far superior to the slums. And he incidentally tried to spend a night there and found the rats and the situation so awful. He actually aborted the night early. But what he recognised out of his experience with the people over a longer time in the so-called slums was that he could come and build the most, you know, fantastic hygienic accommodation, but it would actually destroy the community and the togetherness that they had. Because of the way they lived, they were helping each other out all the time and were, we would think, in each other's pockets, but it created a profound community that he recognised if he went and built his lovely Western hygienic buildings.
It would destroy something very precious.
So that's a bit similar, I think.
Yeah, I think so. And so the challenge in us, I mean, here it's, you know, there's various words in this passage about joy and rejoice, even while you're facing trials. You know, so right now this coronavirus feels like a huge test of many of us in all sorts of ways.
Yeah, and I think people are feeling people are feeling the isolation extremely keenly. It's pointing out, putting into sharper relief a loneliness they may already experience.
And the anxiety around the death unknown. And our human fragility, all of those issues are raised for us very starkly in a way that we can't ignore.
Yeah, and I think also if we're exposed to the amount of media that we are, there's also a level of anxiety that's exacerbated as well, which contributes to people's suffering, really.
Yeah, I agree. So, I mean, let me put it to you then quite starkly, how do we rejoice, or what practices, what helps you, Fran, rejoice and maintain hope in times like this? Because this is what this text is kind of asking us to do, challenging us to do.
I think, you know, my answer would be to gather with a community that believes that this is true, right? Well, there's a challenge. We can't gather. I think what does help me is to read these letters, read the texts and the tradition of the church, and that's in the prayers of the church as well as the scriptures here before us.
It reminds us we're not the first people to face such things, I think.
No, absolutely. And that there's been a lot worse.
Yeah. That's right.
So that would be my first answer. And
I think, too, there's something, one of the things I've been trying to do at the moment and is in many ways incredibly basic, but is actually to just find a few things every day to give thanks to God for.
Yeah, gratitude.
So it's that practice in gratitude, which has taken on a life of its own beyond the church. But actually, you know, it's that giving thanks to God and noting what we do have in our lives that does bring us joy and does give us hope and does put a smile on our face, that the gifts of God continue even while we are anxious and that they're suffering.
And that there will actually be gifts that we can't name here right now out of this experience. There will be new recognitions, you know, that will a new norm, whatever we go back to, what will we leave behind?
Yeah. I agree.
You know, so.
And there's a nice connection here in verse 8 of 1 Peter chapter 1 with the John 20 reading, which is that famous story of the doubting Thomas. So, I mean, I guess I want to say pastorally at this time, if you equally have some doubts, that's
embraced by the tradition.
That it's in the tradition. You know, Thomas continues on as a person in the faith despite asking some hard questions.
And I think he's been unfairly treated as well. I am convicted that John has him in his scriptures in this way to comfort those of us who have not seen Jesus in the, you know, in person as the first witnesses did.
Yep.
Going, well, Thomas has, and he asked the hard questions. You know, you're embraced in that. And I think Peter's talking to a similar community who didn't know Jesus face to face.
That's right. Never met the historical ministry. Jesus. Yep. Yeah, he talks about whom you love without seeing.
Without seeing. And
John puts that differently. Blessed are those who believe without seeing.
So I think in this time of when people are feeling really lonely, that those are words of comfort and words of truth.
Yes. Yep.
And that the loneliness is embraced by God. Like there's a God-forsakenness for some people in this. Yeah. And that is what the cross is about. Yep.
Yeah.
So that's where I'd go perhaps in a sermon.
I think so.
I mean, have we talked about a scholar colleague of ours who's suggested we delay Easter celebrations?
No, let's
maybe finish with this.
Yeah, so we'll put a link to this. A colleague of ours, Gary Deverell, wrote an article recently that was very thoughtful talking about the church in this time and should we stay in Lent.
Lent and quarantine and extending it.
Yeah. I've equally seen memes on Facebook just recently about this is the Lentiest Lent ever.
Yeah, I didn't want to give up this much.
Yeah, that's right. We've been I appreciate so much of what Gary wrote in that article. It's very thoughtful, but for me the challenge is not staying in Lent, even though it might feel like we are, but actually
that back to that question of how do you celebrate amidst a reality that looks like you shouldn't.
Exactly.
You know,
and that. All of these readings today speak of the hope of the resurrection. This was the fundamental game changer for early Christians, that if Jesus, who died this awful death, could be raised by God, there was hope for all of us that death is not the end. Mm. This is a real grounded hope in God's action and God's promise that life can be transformed.
And that's a cause for praise and rejoicing.
Exactly. Well, thank you for listening. Yeah. You've been listening to By the Well, a podcast brought to you by the Uniting Church in Australia, Pilgrim Theological College, and produced by Adrian Jackson.
Thanks for listening.